Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. So every year it's the same thing. Around this time of the year, the Jewish holidays, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, I'm not exactly sure who says what, depending on, I guess, where you grew up in New York City. Since I am not a member of a congregation, I don't belong to a synagogue, and since I am not particularly religious, I always have this feeling, and this is something obviously, you know, the older I get, the more I get these constant revelations about how much what I sort of, in a petty way, in a kind of a petty childish way, attributed to the world and bad luck and to, you know, to other people's doing to me, where I was a victim, the more I see that I really am the author of so many of my own problems. In fact, maybe closer to 90% of them, you know, except for certain things that come out of the blue that affect you or certain things you can't control. I mean, some people say there's hardly anything you can control. But looking at it the other way, that's true. But looking at it the other way, it seems to me there is so much more than I would have been able or should have been able to control if I had had a different mindset, if I didn't assume that the whole deck was stacked against me or that it was other people or the world or bad luck or ill fate or whatever it was. Although there was plenty of that, but still. Anyhow, this time of the year, it's always the same thing, too. So, I mean, I should, and there's always an action connected with these revelations, which is either stop, you know, feeling this way if I feel lonely or irritated or angry or, you know, or stop feeling this way or feel this way, don't feel this way anymore by doing something about it. Somehow figure out a way to just accept the fact that this is how things are, which is difficult to do, you know. But to feel separated or divorced or lonely from your own group of people, and my own group of people always happened to be, because I was born that way and raised in that, what would you call it, a group, a tribe, a race? No, there's some word for it, but a religion. But raised among Jews. So I see, you know, on these days, especially on Rosh Hashanah, is a happy time, and Yom Kippur is a contemplative time. But families, it's a time when families get together and rituals are practiced and people go to the synagogue more than they usually would go. And so I think it's up to me if I want to, and this would have to start next year, if I really want to be part of this and don't want to feel left out like some kind of alien creature when I walk the streets, especially in my neighborhood, which is a pretty although New York is a very rapidly changing place, it's still a very sort of Jewish neighborhood. Well, there is a lot of Jews in the neighborhood, put it that way, and there are synagogues. That it's up to me to join a synagogue if I want to be part of all of this. And when it comes to believing in God, I don't know. I don't know. Closer to mortality, I find myself praying a lot to some form of something. And I always wonder what it is exactly I'm praying to, but I'm not really sure. Not really sure, but these things are all developing. These things are developing. And what happened when I was a kid, I grew up and my grandmother was the one who was religious. Everybody else in the family were second generation or not religious, or some people in the family were sort of militant atheists. But my grandmother came over from the old country, went through all kinds of trouble. And whether or not she was religious, she never really said that she prayed and believed in God, and she didn't go to the synagogue that much. But she did practice all the rituals. So we had during Passover a Seder and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we had various rituals we do. We went to the synagogue, we dressed up, we went to the synagogue, and on Yom Kippur we fasted, and she presided over all this. And the minute that my grandmother died when I was 15 years old, the whole family just sort of disintegrated in every possible way. But in this particular way, it disintegrated in any terms of religious rituals or belonging or attending synagogues, which is a shame. Because I think people need, it doesn't have to be religion, but it helps if you are struggling with, you know, life and who isn't. To gather together, even if you don't believe in God, to gather in some place like the Quakers or whatever it would be. You know, I'm not saying they don't believe in God. And families intermingle and people get together and they combine their doubts and their awe and their belief and their feeling of a soul or not, or even whatever. But even if they're doubting, even if they don't believe, that they get together with other people who feel similarly. And it's a thing I wish that we had maintained, but there was nobody to maintain it. My grandmother held the whole place together like glue. And a lot of rituals disappear, you know, when family rituals, if there's a strong parent who's holding it together. I mean, I've noticed that before. If people aren't brought up and to believe, have their own beliefs or to practice the rituals themselves, and they just do it for the sake of one strong parent, that's the way it goes. That's the way it goes. And when that parent goes, the whole thing goes. By the way, what I'm talking about right now is something I was just noticing, because today is last night, actually. But today when I was coming down to this studio, passing through my neighborhood and a couple of other neighborhoods, I noticed that same feeling. And I'll be seeing it for this week and for the next week when Yom Kippur is here, that feeling of not being part of the tribe, of the group, of the religion. This, so I said, by the way, this has almost nothing to do, or maybe it does, I don't know, with what I intended to talk about today. And what that was last week, or it was back closer to almost 2 weeks ago, my wife and I went to take a trip to Connecticut to visit my wife's mother. She lives up in Connecticut in a nice neighborhood, and like a lot of neighborhoods in Connecticut, it's peaceful, it's quiet, it's clean, it's green. It is the opposite of Manhattan. There's not sirens every 2 seconds, and there's not trash all over the place, and there are not millions of people, and there are not cars and buses honking horns and exhausts. It's a nice visit. And, of course, my wife's mother is getting older now, and you know, my wife wants to see her as often as she can. It's a it's an hour trip, roughly, by train on the Metro North station. Metro North, part of the MTA. I'm not exactly what the relationship is. But the station, we live on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. The station is in Harlem. The Metro North station that we get on to take the train to this town in Connecticut where my wife's mother lives is in Harlem. And we take a bus from our neighborhood, and it goes all the way up to, well, not that far, but it goes up about 20, 30 blocks to 125th Street in Harlem, one of the most famous blocks in American history, and certainly in Black American history. 125th Street in Harlem was, and in some ways still is, the main drag of Harlem. There were times off and on over different decades when it had a certain glory to it. During the Roaring Twenties, there was a lot of nightclubs and famous nightclubs, the Cotton Club, other places like that. It was a time of the Harlem. There was a time of the Harlem Renaissance when there were famous writers and poets that lived up there and produced incredible work, dance, art, painting, all kinds of things. And the development of radiating out from there a certain extremely respectful Black middle class, usually gathered around the church. So Harlem has its, you know, had its ups and downs. There was always, because of racism and because of generations after slavery, there's always the unemployment and the crime and the addiction and the misery and the poverty always there. But there was a time, times fluctuated back and forth when it was always a strong, pockets anyhow, or even larger than pockets, depending on the decade back in the 20th century, of a strong middle class and then, like I say, sort of artistic flourishing, you know, of composing and music and jazz and dance and art. But 125th Street was for a long time. Harlem, before Black people migrated from down south to various northern cities, Harlem had been, originally it was founded by the Dutch, because it's Harlem is a Dutch name. I'm not sure what it means or what it refers to, or if it names an old city that was in Holland. But it was the Dutch originally, then different generations of people, and there was a time when the Jews and the Italians lived in Harlem. Then they moved out to other boroughs where it was leafier and greenier when they got more of an education and got some money. And Blacks moved in. I think probably starting around 1910, and certainly by the 1920s, it was pretty much a Black neighborhood. So we went across 125th Street, and I was astounded by the, I hadn't been there for a little while, for about a year or two. And there was some of this going on before I had, gone to this station here. But I was amazed by the tremendous amount of pure demolition and construction. The whole city, all of Manhattan, I don't know about the rest of the city, but all of Manhattan, New York City is an old city for America. It's an old city. It's busted. It's broken. The pipes are broken. Sewage pipes, electrical connections, cables, water pipes, everything underground is busted and broken and old and has to be fixed constantly. So they're always tearing up the streets. And then they're always laying all the fiber optics and the new cables for everything. that bring us all this wonderful entertainment, some of it good, some of it just, you know, endless trash. But there, these companies, Verizon and others, are always digging up the streets. So they're digging it up to repair the streets, and Verizon is digging it up to put down the cables, and Con Edison is there to fix the gas lines and to replace, and then other people are replacing. So the whole city, it looks like some kind of strange nightmare or dream, where the whole city is just one huge, loud, drilling machines, screaming, yelling construction site. It's just an astounding mess. And also, there people are tearing down buildings. A lot of the buildings are old, and they're being torn down, not necessarily because they have to. Some of them are old and have to be torn down. But most of them are being torn down, a lot being torn down, and huge modern condominiums are being put up in their place. And on the street level, these condominiums are, and these are for people who are upper middle class or even upper class. So the whole city is being gentrified. Income inequality is massive and gigantic in New York City. So all these places are being torn down. People can't afford to pay the rents. People are being evicted. People are being sort of pushed out one way or the other. There's gentrification in New York City. They call it gentrification, which is kind of a polite word for basically huge populations, some white, some black, but mostly black and Latino, being pushed out of old neighborhoods where they had family stores and where they had lived for a long time. Some of them slums, some of them just respectable middle class or lower middle class places, being pushed out and being taken over, all this demolition and construction of these huge, ugly buildings. I mean, really ugly buildings, huge, tall glass and steel buildings. And the whole city, where all this demolition and construction is going on the streets and in the buildings, the whole city is gets that orange color. Does that happen outside of New York? I don't know. Where there's orange tape, orange netting, orange barricades. It's like the city has turned orange. And every single block, it seems, in the city, every neighborhood, every place is festooned with orange, like I say, orange traffic cones, orange barricades, tapes, nets over buildings. It's just like the city has turned orange. And when you see, it's not a really restful color either. Added to all the turbulence, and the traffic is worse than ever in New York City. It's become very congested. So it's incredible. It's like being inside a kind of carnival and kaleidoscope all at one time. So we're going up to Connecticut, right, to get some quiet and clean and peaceful, right? And Connecticut is essentially, you know, mostly whites up in Connecticut. And, you know, we got to go through Harlem. And we got to go through Harlem to get to the Metro North Station, which is at, in the middle of Harlem. There's West Harlem and there's East Harlem. This is sort of in the middle of Harlem on 125th Street. And as we go through this place, we see that there are still a few, with all this construction and demolition and all these new buildings going up and all the condos and everything. And at the bottom, you know, of these are all the national chain stores. Now, I know this is happening everywhere. It happened in the neighborhood I live in. It's been happening for decades and happens more all the time, is that these chain stores like Victoria's Secret and Coach Leather and Barney's Men's Stores and then Verizon Stores and Chase Manhattan Bank and, national chain drug stores, Rite Aid and other places like that, CVS, are all, you know, have replaced family stores. So they're not really neighborhoods anymore. They're not really neighborhoods anymore. I mean, people are being, you know, priced out of these residences. The prices are over the top. It's almost impossible even for middle-class people or what used to be called middle-class people to live. And it hits harder in a place like Harlem, which, like I say, has been historic, for 100 years now, a historic black neighborhood, for better and for worse, right? Ghetto, a neighborhood, a place of pride, a place of misery. And still, as you go down, as our bus is going towards the Metro North Station, there are still some of the old stores there. You know, Liberian, you used to go down Harlem, you know, until like 20, 30, 50, 60 years ago, it was everybody there was black. The stores were, and the only people who weren't there, who weren't black there, were people who worked for the city. Police officers, and mostly white, almost exclusively white at one point. Police officers, some construction workers, sanitation workers called garbage men back in the day. It was okay to call them garbage men. Maybe they didn't seem to mind so much. But and social workers, that kind of thing, and almost always white. And this is the way the neighborhood was. And lots of, like I say, for a long time, lots of misery and terrible poverty and unemployment, even when the city, even when the country wasn't experiencing, you know, a depression. The depression, of course, was 10 times worse, 100 times worse than Harlem. but still some, you know, you would see all, you know, all, and businesses, a lot of the businesses were owned, if they were small businesses or clothing stores or small department stores. Unfortunately, some of these businesses were owned by whites who didn't live in Harlem anymore, had moved out and had black people working for them. But they were owned by whites, and that was a source of a lot of anger and trouble and demonstrations, which Al Sharpton got involved in and some other people in the 80s and 90s. But still, it was mostly, you saw mostly black faces. And as the bus was going down to the, going across to the Metro North station, there were still some of the old stores, and you would see kind of old African roots and some modern Africans too, you know, like who had arrived in Harlem, Liberian hair braiding, barbecue, you know, somebody like Jones Barbecue or whatever. These old businesses were still there. But they were, you know, they were fading fast, just like in my neighborhood. They got put out of business, and the neighborhood feel went out the window, and it's all sort of like a TV commercial now. In my neighborhood, you know, you walk back and forth, up and down, and all you see is Verizon, Chase Manhattan Bank, and Rite Aids, and huge condominiums, and then luxury stores, tremendous luxury stores. That, of course, people like me couldn't possibly afford. But there's a lot of very wealthy people who have moved into my neighborhood. And, you know, it's white over black. Now, I'm thinking to myself as I go through Harlem here, and there's a lot of boarded up stores, which is the sorriest sight in the world. Many, many stores are just boarded up because, you know, no deal has been made yet for the building when the demolition and construction hasn't started. And boarded up buildings, boarded up storefronts, stores that have been in business, I don't know for how long, family stores. When they're boarded up like that, it looks like a death has taken place. There's an absence, a terrible absence and a bad feeling. And it radiates out from the store onto the sidewalk and into the other areas. So right next to these construction areas and right next to some of the remaining stores are many, many boarded up stores. And it's a sad sight to see. And I'm thinking, you know, what's the positive side? Is there any positive side to all this stuff? Because it all looks awful to me. And who am I, a white person, a white middle class, or, you know, I don't know, I'm not even middle class anymore. What's middle class in America? Is there a middle class? Well, let's see, is it upper class and lower class? That's the way it's going here. Income inequality is out of control. But who am I, you know, a white person from, you know, a lower middle class area of the city and living a kind of maybe middle-class life right now, to mourn the loss or the change in Harlem? I mean, I really don't have the cultural, racial, or even historical, you know, bona fides to really say a thing like that. So what's positive about this? I mean, there'll be construction jobs, right? There'll be construction jobs. There'll be lots of construction jobs, although many of those are, you know, are white jobs. You know, there was a huge struggle and still is in New York to have black people in construction jobs. But also there'll be, you know, like lots of other places in the country, there'll be these awful, you know, the lots of new low-wage jobs, you know, for the McDonald's that are replacing the local family barbecues, for all the stores, the drug stores and the large chain department stores and everything else. No Walmart has moved in there yet. It'll be like the rest of the country. There'll be lots of jobs, I suppose, for people who don't have jobs there now, But these jobs will be paying $10 or $15 an hour. And who could possibly live on that? Who could live on that? Nobody, really. So the government will have to subsidize them, and rich people who don't get taxed that much basically will get away with murder, like the Walmart, you know, like the you know, Waltons or whatever their name is. Is it the Waltons who own Walmart? You know, and McDonald's, they hire people for these low wages, and people can't really live on that. Even if it goes to $15 an hour, which is the goal now, people can't live on that in this country. I mean, like I say, even middle-class people have struggling with everything costs so much now. You go shopping for a couple of items, it's like $30. Tube of toothpaste is $6, whatever. You know, it's extraordinary. But these people, they can't live on this. And this gentrification is taking place where upper-middle-class white people all through Harlem, and then now you can see it on 125th Street, that's taking place, is moving all the black people basically out. And where are they going? To poor neighborhoods in the Bronx, or maybe out of state to other poor neighborhoods, or I don't know. And you know what? The question is asked, where do all these dispossessed people go? Well, the answer is, in America, who cares where they go? Who cares where they go? They just have to go. Just go, and nobody really cares. That's America. You know, whatever. Progress is made. New people come in. This is all white people almost entirely, these new people living in these condominiums or, you know, owning these new stores or managing them are almost entirely white. And it doesn't matter where the black people go. They can go where they have always went. Where's that? Who cares? That's America, right? That's America. And the other thing I notice as the bus is headed towards the Metro North Station is that there are white people, right? White people everywhere on 125th Street. This is something you never saw before in Harlem, was white people just walking the streets. There are people, tourists, taking pictures. There are people who obviously live in some of these condos, you know, a couple of blocks away, or some of the just-built condos, who are residents. They're strolling, you know, their kids. They're you know, to see white people there is extraordinary, believe me. I mean, 45 years ago, let's go back a long way now. I was a probation officer, and I used to visit 125th Street, and I used to visit Harlem, take the subway up to 125th Street. And, you know, like I say, at that time, almost the only white people you saw were social workers, cops, garbage men, firemen, and usually people, probation officers like me. And you were not wanted there. I mean, the place was a black place. You were not wanted there. I mean, I had somebody walk up to me when I was up there once as a probation officer trying to find somebody to visit to talk about some, you know, alleged crime. And some guy just got up a stoop, walked over to me and said, "What are you doing here, white boy? You don't belong here. You need to go home." I mean, that was Harlem, right? So now we're walking across and there it is. There it is, all the construction, the condominiums, the low-wage jobs. And it's basically, you know, it's a sinking feeling, because what you're seeing is money. What you're seeing is America. You're seeing white over black and money over people. White over black and money over people. I mean, after all, black people once upon a time in this country were property, and they're still beaten down. You can see what goes on. Cops are still shooting them. There's still poverty. There's still misery. There's still crime. And will America ever recover from this? I don't really know, but it's still rough. And when I look at 125th Street and I look at Harlem, nobody is mourning, including black people, the loss of beaten up old filthy buildings or, you know, junkies and addiction and misery and crime. But still, there's a larger sign of these things of money over people, and white over black. And it's still rough to be black. And you could see it more now in Harlem, maybe than you ever saw before.
If some of you want to dance, this is a good one. If some of y'all want to slow drag and things, y'all to kind of do it in some aisles a little bit there. But Tuesday's just as bad. Oh, night, they call it storm.
The eagle flies on Friday. Lord, and I go out, and everybody goes out to play. Good God, man. Everybody knows that everybody gets paid on Friday. Saturday you're supposed to go out and get down. But now you got Sunday morning, you go to church.
Yeah, Lord have mercy. So the bus is moving along towards the Harlem Metro North train station to take us out of the city to this basically quiet, clean, green neighborhood. Lots of them in Connecticut, mostly white neighborhoods. And something to look forward to, because the city can beat you up with the noise and the crowds and everything, and the getting and the spending and the doing. So as we're going along, seeing all this like drilling, and there's a lot of traffic, you know, because of all the construction sites in the city, there's traffic is astounding. It's just astounding. I mean, it crawls along wherever you go. You don't go anywhere quick unless you take the subway. But if you're, in a cab or in a car or in a truck or anything or a van, traffic is just jammed everywhere in the city, mostly because of all the construction work taking up and there's, you know, the cables being laid and the pipes being fixed and everything and the gas lines being fixed. So it's all, streets are torn up. There's all these orange things all over the place, and there's like something that was once four or five lanes is one lane. So there's lots of traffic. And in the midst of all this, I'm looking on both sides and all the drilling and the demolition is going on. In the midst of all this, what I guess is called progress. Progress is a funny word. But progress are still in one of these transition areas, like especially on 125th Street, there are still these like vacant lots. There are vacant lots. And they are, there's just something so forlorn and awful about them, especially when they're right next to the construction of these giant, shiny steel and glass buildings. There are these really down vacant lots with weeds in them and people lying around looking like dead bodies, and the detritus of the modern world, old rubber, you know, old tires and shopping carts that are twisted and rusted, and mattresses that people are still using, you know, stained, crummy mattresses and junk that's been thrown out, stuff that has been there for 20, 30 years. I mean, some of these, you know, but even more recently, and weeds growing up and, you know, holes in the ground. And it just looks like a bombed out remnant of what happened soon after some sort of terrible world war. And there are people in there too. And in a lot of these, in front of the boarded up stores, and this is, you understand, right next to brand new stores that have opened up, you know, like chain stores, and people going in and out, and tourists and white people walking in their babies and strollers, and tourists from all over the world, white tourists taking pictures, are nodding junkies. In front of these boarded up stores are junkies nodding off, and people sleeping on the hot sidewalk, and people just nodding, and people on crutches and looking miserable, like, you know, just a terrible, terrible sight. And they're everywhere in front of these boarded up buildings and stores, and outside in front or in part of these vacant lots or just plainly on the sidewalk. And apparently there's some new drug in Harlem that people are addicted to, and that's ruining people's lives. Not cocaine and heroin so much anymore, because that's too expensive. It's something called K2, which is a form apparently of synthetic marijuana, and it's got some really evil, nasty chemicals in it. Makes people really sick and nuts, but it gets them high, you know, and it costs a whole lot less. And it's sold by, and in East Harlem, there are still a lot of bodegas. That's more of a Latino, or is it Hispanic, the right word? Hispanic neighborhood, that part of Harlem. East Harlem, which was once mostly Italian, maybe it was Jewish part of it, but mostly Italian until they moved out to the suburbs and to other places, is mostly Hispanic now. And there's many bodegas there, and apparently a lot of the drugs are sold from there. And there are dealers and people hustling on the streets. And but this drug is now, this is the drug that's ruining people's lives. And so you pass by it all, the tourists, the white tourists, people going in and out of the stores, the construction work going on, these new shiny buildings and chain stores being built. And, you know, it's the feeling of money and the feeling of wealth and the feeling of this American, you know, progress of building up money and materialism is all there right next to all these vacant lots and bad boarded up stores, which some of the boards have been ripped off, and people nodding off, and this poverty and disease. And it seems to me that that these people and these vacant lots with these weeds and these nodding off junkies and people sleeping on the sidewalk and people, you know, just like pawing at each other and people having fights with each other. And to me, these places are like sores. They look like sores, but these are like sores that reveal the deeper sickness of the whole country. And, you know, I know this is not limited, this kind of stuff. I mean, these places occur in every city. These kinds of scenes occur in every city, and they occur in suburbs. Not in suburbs, but in small towns all over the country. I mean, it's terrible income inequality, which is creating this kind of left behind mentality of people just who are ill and who are sick and addicted and who are poor, who are just left basically to rot and nobody much cares. Is it overpopulation? I don't know. Is it racism? Is it the materialism that's inherent in the American soul? I don't know. But to me, these boarded up stores, these lots and these people nodding off and all the poverty that you see, they're like sores which reveal a deep bone sickness, the deep bone sicknesses of America, which is money over people and, you know, racism, white over black. And this is our karma, and it just keeps going on and on and on. Well, finally, we arrive at the station, the Metro North station. And there are even more junkies and sick people and miserable people and people on crutches and old people who are sick and people who are, like, you know, staggering on the sidewalk. And behind the station, which is very busy, people going in and out, and there's cabs piled up to take people different places. And we arrive at the station, and then there are these there's a small little city of the poor and the miserable and junkies right behind, underneath the elevator. These are elevated tracks. The station is on Park Avenue and 125th Street. This is not the Park Avenue, 30 or 40 blocks, only 2 miles downtown, where all the hedge fund managers and the bankers and the entrepreneurs and maybe the real estate owners who are building and creating this hell on earth, although they call it progress, that are pushing all these black people out and who are maintaining the same kind of America that we basically have always had, only it's shiny looking, so you'd have to look beneath the surface. This is not the same Park Avenue. It is Park Avenue, but it's not the same. And so if you could walk 2 miles straight back down there, those people wouldn't be allowed. The people on 125th Street who are lurching and staggering and nodding off, they would be picked up and removed immediately down there. But here they're allowed to just rot away, or who cares what happens to them. So we get to the Metro North station, and there's these people, and plenty of cops around. Plenty of cops, because there's a lot of, you know, white people traveling back and forth to the suburbs and coming off the, arriving from the suburbs and looking for cabs. And so the black cops are there, and white cops, black cops, Latino cops. Cops are varied now, but it's still more white cops. And they look menacing and big and nasty. And, you know, it's, you walk into this station, the station has always had a kind of a bad aura to it. For many years now, the bathrooms have been locked in this state. There's old green paint. There's old green paint, and it's some of it's peeling, and sometimes they fix it up, but the floors are dirty. The bathrooms are locked because for a long time, junkies used the bathrooms to shoot up and to sleep in and maybe to mug people when it's. So the bathrooms are all locked. And what you see is a lot of white people. There are some Latino and some black traveling northwards, either probably for jobs that they're going to do outside the city and then come back to their neighborhoods in the city, or to visit other poorer areas where maybe they live because they're working in the city up in Connecticut towns. But mostly it's white people who are very prosperous looking. They're young. They're on their cell phones. And one thing I notice when I'm there is there's no ticket agents. There's no ticket agents. Used to be 20 years ago when I would go up to this town to visit my wife's parents, there were ticket agents at every booth, and it wasn't as automated. Now, the windows are boarded up like the stores are boarded up. There are plywood, you know, boards in front of the windows. There's not one person at a ticket agency. It's automation. You have to use these machines with your credit cards. And who's basically got all that? Mostly white people. And this is automation, of course, is happening everywhere, you know, banks, subways, every place, all over the country. I mean, what happens to these jobs? Where do they go? I mean, what happens to them? I don't know. Does the country care? I guess not. I don't know. So finally, you get on a train. The train arrives, and it's clean and neat and shiny, and there are smartphones, and there are laptops, and people on there, and then a lot of the people are, you know, you can look at people and just see they're young, you know, in their 20s and 30s, and a lot of these people are just born rich. They grew up rich in some very rich suburbs, and they've got their, they've got their expensive shorts and their sneakers and their T-shirts on, and they just look wholesome and clean, and they have a kind of look of ownership, that, you know, not a lot of white people do who are upper middle class or upper class. And they have their, you know, like I say, their laptops and their cell phones. And some of them are carrying tennis rackets because this is, was the time of the U.S. Open, which just ended. And so there's, so we're on a train. And we passed, you know, we have passed through all this poverty and misery and drug addiction and alleged progress, and we got on the train, and it's this is like a societal or cultural blindness that occurs, right? You have to sort of put blinkers on, or you don't put them on, and you feel it all. And it's a strange cognitive dissonance, to put it mildly, to pass through this and get on these trains. So you look out the train window as it pulls away from the station, and you see, you know, on the side, you know, some of the still, you're still in a poor neighborhood. It's going to take a while to pull out of the poor neighborhood. And even into the Bronx, the South Bronx, you know, old lots and warehouses and car repair places and stuff at the edge of a city that you see at the edge of a city, you know, bus parks and truck parks and, you know, fueling stations and, you know, old buildings that look beat up. And as the train passes out from there and gets even to more of a middle class area, still, you see, what do you see at the side of when you look out the window? You see trash along the side of the tracks. Trash. It's just old, the same thing. Old rubber tires and old lamps and junk and weeds and trash and garbage. And it just occurs to me that it's a kind of, there's a kind of, narcissism to America. Is it narcissism is the word? I don't know. Narcissism, this materialism where the country like consumes, it consumes stuff and just throws out what it doesn't want and doesn't really care about what happens to it. This refuse just litters. I mean, on 125th Street, the refuse is basically people. It's people. And, you know, everywhere you go in the country, you know, you know, for every new condominium, for every chain store, there is the wreck of a life of a family store that's been put out of a business, and who knows what happened to them. For everything that happens there on 125th Street, these condos that go up and everything, there are people who are, and gentrification, people are moved out of the place, and there is just all this junk. Junk and rubber and rust on the side you know, of the train. And so you're in this shiny train with the people on it and, you know, prosperous-looking people. It's not everybody. I mean, there's a lot of middle-class or lower-middle-class hardworking people who have, you know, jobs in and live in towns in Connecticut. Not everybody's rich up there. It's not so clearly defined, you know, hardworking people who decided to live in the suburbs. And they're on the train, too, people who had come down to see ball games or whatever, and who were visiting in the city, you know, who went to various shows or movies or went to Times Square and ended up going back home. But I'm thinking, with all this refuse everywhere, you know, you're inside your condo, you're on this clean, shiny train. Tickets cost a lot, so it's hard to pay for it unless you're, you know, already in the middle class. And it's America. It's America, which consumes everything. People and material, gold from all over the world, oil, gas, clothing, and all these places from Pakistan make clothing where people, sneakers, the whole, you know, world has supplied America. Things are changing now, but the whole world has supplied America. Now, China's involved in this, too. You know, they're becoming like America. But it's basically slave labor overseas. You know, when a factory burns down in Pakistan, which makes clothes, cheap clothes for Walmart, yeah, well, you know, it makes the headlines for a few days, and then so what? That's the way it goes. The whole, there are millions and millions and millions of people laboring away all over the world in mines, in the mud in the Congo, providing stuff that, elements that are needed for cell phones, you know, kind of special metals and things. And it's this crazy income inequality, and it's this, and oil and gas, and we consume and consume and consume all the energy we use in this country. I think America, at last count I read, consumes 25% of the energy in the whole world and has a much, 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 much lower percentage of the actual people in the world. Stadiums ablaze, you know, cities ablaze at night with lights. And all of this is costing something to somebody. But in America, basically, the attitude is, I've got mine I mean, really, who cares? And yeah, there are environmental movements. There are people who are concerned about this internally with wages. But the more you see this, the more America was always like this to begin with, obviously. And this continues. There is a kind of narcissism, a kind of, it doesn't matter what happens to other people as long as I get mine. If I leave a trail of broken hearts and ruined lives behind me, as long as I'm getting what I need, as long as I'm happy, as long as I get what I want. And again, you think to yourself, and everything is becoming more and more like that everywhere. Even in my neighborhood, which is an upper middle class neighborhood, people have stopped caring about anybody else. I mean, you have people who are upper middle class people. It's not like you're talking about staggering drunks or anybody. You know, there are people that they don't, you know, there's trash in front of every store, no matter what kind of store it is. People talking on their cell phones everywhere at the top of their lungs. It doesn't matter. Nobody cares about anyone. Their dogs, they let their dogs piss on the sidewalks. So the sidewalks of this, which should be, you know, a very fancy neighborhood, are completely, you know, littered with puddles of dog piss. I mean, it's just, there's just trash thrown everywhere. People just let things go. There's no concern for other people anymore. And I'm thinking to myself, well, this is the way America is, but how do you turn it around? Do you just say, well, that's the way it is, and just hide your head in the sand? Or maybe what you can do is just keep getting involved and getting involved. But it seems more hopeless to turn this giant ocean liner of selfishness and money and racism around. I mean, it's always been this way, but it's greater than it's ever been before. But obviously, what you got to do is you got to keep trying. You got to talk about it. You got to join organizations. You got to volunteer. You got to, you got to donate. You got to try to keep aware of it, but it gets harder and harder all the time. But what else can you do but try?
Mississippi, surrounded by a world that ain't so pretty. His parents give him love and affection to keep him strong, moving in the right direction, living just enough for the city.
bus driver, I'm getting on that horse. Thanks, bye. Wow. New York, just like I pictured it. Skyscrapers and everything.
The jury of your peers, having found you guilty, 10 years.